Creativity is both one of the essential pleasures and great mysteries of life. Where does the impulse come from, and how can it be cultivated? For 9 years, in her position as the original executive producer of Studio 360, one of the most popular shows from Public Radio International and WNYC, Julie Burstein explored this subject with some of the greatest artists, musicians, actors, and writers of our time. And she's written a book called Spark, which is a distillation of what she learned from them. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased that it brings Julie back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
You've been here both as a guest and as a guest host.
Yes. I usually sit at the red microphone.
Was Studio 360 conceived as an exploration in creativity?
It really was. The initial idea was, actually the show first was called Hot Ticket, but they went online and found what Hot Ticket actually was online and decided, no, we shouldn't call it that. So it was called Studio 360, and what we really wanted to look at is what we called where art and real life collide. So looking at creativity, not just in high arts, but in pop culture and also in life.
And when you were shaping the program and you began to look at the history of other public radio programs, you say you found the landscape was littered with failed programs about art and culture. Why do you think that is?
You know, a lot of the national programs were hugely ambitious, which is wonderful, but also just couldn't sustain themselves. I actually was a part of one a long time ago called The Sunday Show, which was a five-hour arts and entertainment magazine on Sunday afternoons from NPR. And that happened right before NPR went through some really great turmoil, and arts are often the first thing to go.
Well, we faced resistance from previous WNYC managements to how much we were devoting to cultural matters on this show instead of just taking a news-oriented approach. And it was only after, most recent management came in, and I think they also looked at the ratings, they realized that there is an interest in this. But I'm sure it seems to me public radio doesn't always know how to deal with cultural matters. It has a different kind of sense of mission.
I think that that's true. And I think over the years, public radio has become very focused on news. And so a lot of time, arts become arts news. And that's not really where the resonance and the power of creativity lies. What is it? William Carlos Williams, who said, I don't have the exact quote, but about how poetry is not news, but you die if you don't look at poetry, too. I'm not as poetic as William Carlos Williams. I'll find that quote for you.
Few people are as poetic as William Carlos Williams, a great poet. I'm assuming that the title of this book, Spark, is because you believe that there is a spark. Does every artist believe there's a spark? Some just say, you know, it's hard work. I wander around and then suddenly things just start coming together.
Well, that was wonderful in that some, yes, say, I have to work really hard. Joyce Carol Oates talks about dreaming. She spends most of her time dreaming before she actually
and looking out the window, she
her
says.
Book. Yes, and it's all in her head. Mozart used to say that too. I wish somebody would commission me to write down my string quartet because it's in my head, but I'm not going to write it down until someone pays me. I think Joyce Carol Oates does it before that happens. But some people did talk about a particular moment that happened in childhood or something that inspired them. And other people, like your friend Chuck Close, talk about the importance of just getting to work.
There's a cliche that to be a true artist, you must suffer. Did you find that adversity had, in many cases, given birth to creativity?
One of the most fascinating things I found as I went back to all these interviews that Kurt Anderson did on Studio 360 was that for a number of artists, the greatest challenge that they faced often led them to their most powerful work. One is the wonderful novelist Richard Ford, and I'd love to play a clip for you. He was incredibly dyslexic as a child.
I was slow to learn to read. Went all the way through school not really reading more than the minimum, and still to this day can't read silently much faster than I can read aloud. But there were a lot of benefits to being dyslexic for me, because when I finally did reconcile myself to how slow I was going to have to do it, then I think I came very slowly into an appreciation of all those qualities of language and of sentences that are not just the cognitive aspects of language, the syncopations, the sounds of words, what words look like, where paragraphs break, where lines break. I mean, I wasn't so badly dyslexic that I was disabled from reading. I just had to do it really slowly. And as I did, lingering on those sentences as I had to linger, I fell heir to language's other qualities, which I think has helped me write sentences.
It's kind of rare for a writer to be dyslexic. It's more common for visual artists and actors. Chuck Close, I think, has talked about his dyslexia. But Richard Ford told you that Faulkner's Absalom Absalom became one of his favorite books. Well, it takes a lot of perseverance for anyone to read that novel. And dyslexic people try to avoid or minimize the reading that they do usually.
Well, that's, you know, he talked about how he came to Absalom Absalom when he was, I think, 19 or 20. And it was the first book he felt he really read. And I think it was because of what he just said, that it wasn't just what the words meant, but it was the rhythm and the melody of the language, too, that really captivated him. And I love hearing him talk about how something that most of us would say, oh, my God, my child is dyslexic, suddenly it becomes the thing that opens a world up for him.
What did he say about the difference between reading a newspaper and reading something by Faulkner?
He said that Faulkner taught him that it isn't just what the words mean, that there is always something underneath and always something about the way the language sounds. He also told me that he won't let a book out until he's read it out loud to his wife. He and his wife read each of his novels out loud to each other before he sends it to his publisher.
You spoke with the poet Donald Hall about dealing with the death of his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon. How did he find that she was sick?
He was on a book tour when she called him up and said, I have this nosebleed that just won't stop, and I feel really ill. And he got on a plane to go home to New Hampshire, and he realized immediately that this was really serious. And what he talks about, he was on Studio 360 a year after 9/11 to talk about the idea of memorials. And some of his most powerful work comes out of the experience of his wife's illness and death. And he often reads these when he goes around the country. And a lot of people come up to him and say, how can you do this? These are so heartbreaking.
And personal.
And he said, you know, this isn't a problem because they've become poems.
They start out as screams of pain. And as I work on them, they will come to be something outside me. It is as if I were working with hacking away at a piece of stone to make sculpture or modeling or trying to paint, adding a little paintbrush here and there, adding a little dash of this and that, so that they become works of art. They become a work of art in the art that I love, that I've tried to practice since I was 12 years old. Then they are objectified. They're out there. They start from the pain. They start from the anguish, these poems do. And then they become something that means to be in itself as language, as sound, as imagery, objects of pleasure, objects that give pleasure.
Now, was he taking notes while she was in the hospital?
He was. He said that he would write poetry, that the two of them were very much people who look things squarely in the face. They did not pretend that she was not dying and that it gave him solace to write these poems.
Part of the problem, some people are cynical. I know I've had any number of guests come on the show to talk about something that they did, and I thought, book deal, the book deal was first. there is concern among some people about exploiting. For example, Sally Mann came under criticism for her nude photographs of her children. Is any topic fair game for an artist?
I think yes, and I think that's what we look to them for, because there's so many topics that in our daily lives we try to avoid, and that's, thank goodness, there are writers or filmmakers who are willing to tackle these things and show us a piece of the world that we might be afraid to look at otherwise.
In many of these poems, he addresses her. What's he telling her or asking?
He often told her jokes, and he said that he got into trouble because a lot of these poems have sometimes very ribald jokes in them. And a friend of his wrote to him and said, I loved the poem until the last stanza. And then, Donald, how could you have done that? And he said, I did it because Jane would have roared with laughter. And that's the other piece of Donald Hall's story. You know, this is something so heartbreaking, yet he was able to approach it with the same kind of joy for life that he has in the rest of his life.
But there also have been a lot of memoirs about dealing with the loss of a loved one. So it would suggest that the public wants to read about this, maybe because the artist to some degree is discussing the things for us that are that we're not sure we can talk about ourselves.
You know, religion does that for some people, and I think for some people, art is the way that they come to terms and cope with the inevitable, which is that this is going to happen to all of us. Let's hope not for a long, long time.
Donald Hall also talked about letting her garden go.
Yes, it's a beautiful poem, and it's also, you know, he talked about the things that he was able to hold on to and the things that he needed to just let go. And that is, for many of these artists, that seemed to be a theme, that there were things that they were able to hold on to and kind of make concrete in their work, and other things that they just had to let go.
My guest is Julie Burstein, who's written a book called Spark, How Creativity Works. It is published by Harper. We tend to think of creativity as a one-person activity, an artist holed up in some garret frantically trying to perfect a singular vision. But isn't collaboration often an important element of creativity?
Absolutely. I think especially as things change, too. And I look at the collaboration you have with your wonderful team here. There's so many aspects of life where you can't do it all alone. And in the book, I look at a couple of key partnerships, people who've been on Studio 360. There's the great filmmaker Ang Lee and the producer and screenwriter James Shamus. And they talk about Ang Lee's first big movie, The Wedding Banquet, that James Shamus actually, it was a tragedy. And Shamus came in and said, wait a minute, and turned it into a comedy, which made it all the more poignant. And there's also a couple who've worked together and lived together. They are both a romantic couple and a business couple, the architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, who gave me the best. Denise Scott Brown said the most important bit of advice she has for people who live and work together is never talk when you're hungry, which I thought was excellent advice for just about anything that we do.
Well, I'm sure that the disagreements they have in their collaboration spill over. This can be a problem if it ruins a dinner or enters into the bedroom. And,
yes.
And it can work the other way too, can't it?
I think so. And they said they try as hard as they can to be, once the door to the office closes, they try to be a married couple and watch television and go out and do the things that they need to do. But they also talked about the kind of intrinsic, what Robert Venturi said was that a friend once told him about T.S. Eliot, who said that the kind of key part is criticism.
And we have a clip. He's talking about T.S. Eliot here.
And he points out that the creative process consisted enormously of critique, of being a critic. It wasn't so much that you were inventing all the time, but that you were getting an idea, and then you were critiquing the idea, and then you were trying it out, and then you worked as a critic towards your own ideas. And so I think Denise and I share that idea, and we work very much as critics. When there's a project that is more on Denise's side, I am a critic, and she and critique it, and vice versa. And I think that's an interesting way of putting it.
I think we can also jumpstart some processes by capping each other's ideas and batting the ideas around between us, sometimes fighting over them, and they get more intense. And sometimes it happens that I say to Rob, look, I just don't think this is working this way. He says, of course it's working. And I said, well, couldn't you think of such and such? He said, no, no, you can't do that. And then a day or so later, he said, well, you know, you remember what you said? Well, look what I did. And so I think and that's a process where he would have done self-criticism eventually, but because of my doubts at that point, I pushed him and he went faster to that position.
Most people who know anything about architecture would recognize the name Robert Venturi, but might not recognize the name Denise Scott Brown. And I've read an awful lot about architects. I've met a few who the cliche is they have huge egos. Doesn't matter how many people are working for them. They're the ones. They are the geniuses behind it all. This must be a real problem for a married couple, especially for her, when everybody says, Robert Venturi, what do you do at the firm?
I think that she talks about that in the book, about how people would say, oh, you're an architect too? And she would say, no, I'm an architect. He's an architect too. And I think it is partly because, as you said when you were talking about collaboration, people do expect that great works of art come out of one brain, like Athena out of Zeus's head, you know, just one person. And the two of them talk about how important it is for them to recognize the contribution of each other.
Do you think part of the problem is also that she's a woman, although there are a few prominent female architects?
You know, I think just recently there has been more recognition of women and partnerships between men and women. So I think things are changing, but they've been doing this for more than 50 years. So she was one of in the forefront.
The architectural community has refused to consider joint nominations for their awards. So they have pretty much turned down all awards, but he took the Pritzker. Why did he do that?
He did. And she said she wouldn't go, that their son went with him, and that everyone knew why she wouldn't go. But I think that comes with quite a significant financial reward, too. So that was a piece of it. You know, one of the things when I'm listening to all of these, one of the biggest challenges of writing the book was I love hearing all these people's voices. So one of the things I really focused on was how do you get that voice on the page? Working in radio for all these years, we're so lucky. We get to hear how people say things. And so that was one of the biggest challenges, but one of the biggest pleasures, too.
Well, one of the creative aspects that people don't realize is that there's a lot of creativity that goes into even preparing for an interview with
Absolutely.
Somebody like this. And it's collaborative in that case, too, because you and your staff and then Kurt Anderson, and then there's a collaboration between the interviewer and the guest.
Yes.
You never know how it's going to go.
No, and you have to be – it's like a dance. You have to be awake and aware and really playing with that person. And that's – you know, the book is not just transcribed interviews. I've taken what people have said and looked for the deeper patterns in them. But the voices are one of the most important pieces there.
You also had a real challenge here because a lot of – the show is about music. It is a radio show. And you had to describe art as well, art and music, two things that, unless you illustrate them, don't really make much sense.
Well, when I first started Studio 360, I remember going to a dinner with a bunch of patrons, and one said, "How do you put art on the radio?" And you know this so well, Leonard, because you do it so beautifully. I think art works better on the radio than it does on something like television, because our imaginations are the things that really connect with anything. And so if you can describe something, whether it's art on the radio or music in a book, if your reader, you want to have a real connection with the reader, and that gives the reader a place to put themselves in.
Well, also in talking about art, you're talking about the creative process, something that the artists themselves think an awful lot about. How did I come to do this? How do I do this? And although they'd like to believe there's a certain amount of magic to it, they understand that that each one of them has an individual approach to creating the thing that they create.
Yes, and that their stories, they can't give us, you know, I joke that I've got a template of the 10 things to do to be creative. Nobody can do that, but we can share stories with each other about how each of us individually becomes creative, and that then can lead me as a radio producer to listen to these stories and think of new ways of doing my work.
You included the story of your marriage in the section on collaborations.
I did, because my husband and I met just as we're sitting here. We were actually fundraising for Garrison Keillor at WNYC. And
he used to run fundraising.
He used to
WNYC.
Run the fundraising and do all the on-air promotions. And he was charged with writing the promos for my radio show. And like Denise Scott Brown and Robert Venturi, he handed me an idea. He wanted to do something about music, how music can come from anywhere. And I said, well, what if instead of talking about music, we talk about literature and fashion and these other things, but illustrate it with music? And he said, oh, interesting idea, and went off and wrote some of the things that I still am most happy with today. In terms of my work. And that led to our collaboration and marriage. I left WNYC and we got together. And I have to say, what I learned from these artists and doing Studio 360 has been incredibly powerful in my home life as well, because you need creativity to deal with kids, with illness, with all of the things that face us.
And you talk about that, the serious challenge of dealing with your son's illness. How did creativity help your marriage in that crisis?
Well, I think because Mark and I knew, Mark Maben is my husband, we knew how to go at problems from different perspectives. it allowed us to talk to doctors and look at the very formal medical way of dealing with what our son was going through, but also think, how would diet fit in and how might there be alternative ways? And actually, by being willing to be open to those different ideas, our son is now, knock wood, doing really well. And his medical doctor said, I don't know how you did this, but just keep going.
There's been a big debate in the literary world anyway as to whether writing can be taught, or writing can be taught, but can creativity be taught?
That is such an excellent question. And I think my belief, and it's partly because this is what I've done for my whole career, is that the best way to learn is through stories, that it's not instruction, do X, Y, Z. It's here's how I found my way. Think about this. I mean, for me, now going back to this book, the idea that the challenges that artists face often shape them and their work, that and that work itself can be a balm. I mean, Donald Hall talks about how after his wife died, he would say to his dog, "Poetry Man is suiting up," because the only happiness he had was the 2 hours a day he could work. Those stories then make me think about my own life. And that, I think, is how creativity can be taught.
And so much of the inspiration for people has to do with their own lives. Even whether it's autobiographical or not, it's going back to where they to their roots, thinking about where they've come from. But I am interested in this whole matter of whether you can teach writing. Nobody asks, can you teach painting or sculpture or music? You have to learn the basic skills. It's that other thing that makes one – you have 100 people in a class.
Right.
One person becomes a major artist and all the rest develop in varying degrees. That's something else, and that's something that's inexplicable. By the way, Julie Burstein and Kurt Anderson will be talking and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca on Warren and Greenwich Street. The book, Spark, How Creativity Works, with a foreword by Kurt Anderson. It is published by Harper. And Julie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. What a pleasure.